Ludovico von Kasthoff, Popoff's indolent, charming, corrupt spymaster, was reprimanded for indiscretion and inefficiency, which was putting it mildly, sacked from his post and sent to the Eastern Front. Dr. Alois Schreiber was now, in effect, the head of German intelligence in Lisbon. Schreiber was a puzzle. A 44-year-old Bavarian with an oval face and greying hair, he was a First World War veteran with a doctorate in law from Erlangen University. He had been the personal courier to his close friend Canaris before being sent to Lisbon to take over from Jebsen's archenemy, Kammler, as head of counterintelligence, although he spoke not a word of Portuguese. His specific duties were obtaining intelligence information concerning enemy armies, gathering information about the possibility of Allied invasion, and in particular the time, location, and strength of such a proposed landing. Bookish and serious, Schreiber was openly disdainful of his dissolute colleagues, and had a reputation among the Abwehr roustabouts and layabouts for being pedantic and ambitious. Jebsen was unsure what to make of this clever, sober, antisocial man. Schreiber is not a Nazi, but nor particularly anti-Nazi, he reported. In fact, Schreiber was not only anti-Nazi, but a conspirator in the spreading plot to topple Hitler. Like some others in the Abwehr, he nursed a quiet but profound hatred of Nazism. In 1942, on the orders of Hans Oster, the deputy head of the Abwehr and a significant figure in the German resistance, he smuggled a Jewish couple named Weiss and their children to Switzerland, and was arrested on suspicion of aiding, abetting, and camouflaging the illegal departure of Jews. He was exonerated after his Abwehr bosses intervened. Before he left for Portugal, Colonel Georg Hansen, another key conspirator, quizzed him closely about his general political attitude. Schreiber was left in no doubt that the conspirators were sounding him out. Something was being planned, and he was under the impression that they wished to ascertain exactly who belonged to them in sentiment, so they would know on whom they could count. They could count on Schreiber. As defeat loomed, a determined band of officers, led by Klaus von Stauffenberg, began planning Hitler's assassination in the attempted putsch, codenamed Valkyrie. These were not soft-hearted liberals, but ruthless military men determined to salvage German honor by destroying Nazism, making peace with the Americans and British, and then turning, with full ferocity, on the Bolshevik menace in the East. A post-war investigation concluded that Schreiber belonged to the group of militarists who sponsored the attempt of 20 July 1944, and that he was sent to Portugal by the 20 July conspirators to ensure having a dependable man in a strategic position who could be called upon. Schreiber would soon receive the call, with calamitous consequences for the double-cross plot. Marie von Gronau, Jebsen's latest sleeping secretary, reported that Berlin was demanding the names of Abwehr members who are believed to be in touch with the British. Jebsen relayed this disquieting news to Dessalles. "We must reckon that they will, in future, pay special attention to us. Even greater care is necessary with regard to meetings." The danger was reflected in most secret sources. Berlin has ordered that a close watch be kept on Artist, presumably on account of the flight of the Vermeerens, as he is known to be a friend of theirs, wrote Tarr. Artist's friends are not now in Berlin, and his enemies are going to make things unpleasant for him. Jebsen was confident. Brandes had been to Berlin and reported that he had defended him strongly. The secretaries were keeping him fully informed of the correspondence with Berlin. Schreiber did not seem particularly hostile, and the order to keep an eye on him was probably just a routine response to the defection of his friend, Erich Vermeeren. "The clouds are nearly over," he told Dessalles, who reported back to London, "Artist in extremely good form. Owing to fact that suspicions against him have died down due to prompt action by his allies, including Brandes." Jebsen's confidence rose further with the news that he would soon be reunited with Popoff. Popoff landed at the now familiar Lisbon airport on February 26th, bearing with him another large slice of Operation Fortitude, including photographs of Admiralty documents, notes on aircraft types, information on rationing, and a doctored parliamentary speech. Within Popoff's cache, as Jebsen had advised, lay a wealth of smaller details that, when put together, would reveal a mighty army assembling in the southeast. Popov had been told to take Yebsen aside as soon and as discreetly as possible, and exert his influence over artist to prevent the latter from getting nervous or excited, and doing foolish things or taking any avoidable risks. If Yebsen raised the idea of bringing Brandes into the plot, he should be urged to take no steps whatever to bring this about, although we would welcome suggestions as to how it might be possible to recruit Brandes. Above all, Yebsen should be encouraged to find out whether the deception was working by obtaining up-to-date details of the German knowledge of the British order of battle. Popov's reception was very different from the sort of welcome laid on by von Kastorf. This time he would be debriefed by Alois Schreiber, a man who, Yebsen warned, had a very great experience of interrogating prisoners. Schreiber asked Yebsen to sit in on the debriefing, which was as intense and penetrating as von Kastorf's had been cheery and perfunctory. For 2 days and nights, pausing only for beer and sandwiches, Schreiber grilled Popov. Yebsen chipped in from time to time with his own sharp questions. Popov later reported that his friend had assisted him cleverly during his interrogation while deliberately appearing to be rather hostile, with the result that Schreiber is satisfied there is no collaboration between artist and tricycle. Popov put on a dazzling performance. Indeed, as he later told Wilson, he was sure he was definitely on top and, as he modestly put it, being the younger man, he stood the strain better than Schreiber. The German station chief seemed utterly convinced by Popov's report and immediately dictated a telegram to Berlin stating that he was an excellent agent and he had no suspicions. Marie von Gronau passed the note on to Yebsen, who gave it to Desalles, who sent it on to London, where the news was passed to Churchill. His first interview with his spymasters passed off in a most satisfactory manner. Popov's confidence was validated when Bletchley Park decoded a message to the German High Command, noting that Agent Ivan had furnished particularly valuable information about the British formations in Great Britain. The report confirmed our own overall operational picture. After the debriefing, Popov and Yebsen hit the town, hard. Yebsen was in funds, having managed to wangle authority to transfer some gold he has put by in Paris, and had bought himself a Rolls Royce, which he could not drive. Yebsen did not seem unduly anxious for his own safety, and spoke of maintaining long-term contact with the British secret services, and wanting to be regarded by them as a reliable agent even after the war. Popov was confident his own high standing in Berlin would protect his friend. They were joined in their carousing by Hans Brandes, Yebsen's new friend. Brandes seemed wary of Popov. Yebsen later suggested why. He is afraid that he, Popov, will report the date and place of the invasion and thus prolong the war. It was an odd thing to say. Brandes often made overtly anti-Nazi remarks, as if fishing for a reaction. Desalles reported, although convinced that Brandes is not trying to trap him, artist always reacts to such suggestions as a good German should. Ian Wilson flew out to Lisbon and met Popov and Yebsen at the safe house. Yebsen was ambitious to do more for the cause. He is keen to go to Germany, as he wanted to do something big for us, Wilson reported. He could arrange to be sent to Germany for a visit under a false name if we really desired it. Wilson thought it safer for Yebsen to remain in Lisbon, particularly after he casually referred to Kulenthal's controlled agents in UK and the need for those to back up whatever Popov reported. Here was proof positive that Yebsen knew the Garbo network, or the Spaniards, as he called them, were bogus. Brandes had brought word back from Berlin on how the British spies were seen in Berlin, which suggested that Popov was now even more valued than Puyol. Ivan Popov is now considered to be by far the best connection, and the Spaniards, as regards quality, are following a long way behind, Brandes reported. The confidence in him has grown very much. Such comparisons were of limited value, since, as Yebsen observed, it was common for members of the Abwehr to run down each other's agents. Still, Brandes was being remarkably helpful, and Yebsen again urged his recruitment. He is certain that Brandis would collaborate with us. Jepsen did not realize, and MI5 did not tell him, that Brandis was an even more slippery opportunist than he knew. Brandis had his own wireless transmitter. With this, he was sending messages to Berlin reporting on Jepsen, whom he was meeting, where he was going, and what he was saying. These transmissions, decoded at Bletchley Park, revealed yet another layer of deception. The man Jepsen considered his close friend, to whom he was prepared to entrust his life by inducting him into his terrifying secret, was betraying him behind his back. "Brandis is playing a game of his own," reported Ian Wilson, a note of fear creeping for the first time into his words. "Brandis is clearly telling tales." 20. Am I not always careful? Brutus, Bronx, Treasure, Tricycle and Garbo would never meet, yet individually and together, as spring advanced and the Allied armies prepared for the biggest amphibious assault in history, they spun a tapestry of lies so thick and wide it would envelop the entire German intelligence system. In April 1944, anxiety was still high and expectations low. Tommy Harris declared that the effort would be worthwhile if the deception caused just one division to hesitate 48 hours before proceeding to oppose our landing in the Cherbourg Peninsula. As the real army mustered in the southwest to attack Normandy, the double agents deployed their fake army in the southeast and the north. At first, Puyol and Harris had merely sprinkled untruths among the chicken feed, but now they began to increase the percentage of false in the mixture until the entire substance of our reports would be based on the false or notional, a creeping barrage of deception. Popov's latest report to Lisbon had established the names and locations of units within the fictional invasion force. Knowing that the Germans would now be paying attention, the double agents started to move these south and east. Most secret sources showed that Garbo's reports, 5 or 6 a day, were being relayed to Berlin promptly and almost verbatim, along with his analysis of their meaning. The hoax was being injected straight into the central nervous system of the Third Reich. The deceivers wondered if they were being too subtle. Would the Germans pick up the hints and reach the right conclusions? As a test, Tar Robertson called in a military expert who had no previous dealings with B1A, sat him down with 40 boxes of paper, the entire double agent traffic from March 1943 to April 1944, and asked him to interpret the lot. The poor man ploughed through the files every day for 2 weeks, and then offered his conclusions as to what the Germans must be thinking. 1. Agents have been at pains to make no definite forecast. 2. Strong likelihood of attack in the Mediterranean at same time. 3. An attack in Norway, possibly of a diversionary nature, prior to the main attack. 4. The initial landings will be made against Belgium and the Pas-de-Calais. The assessment fitted with the deception almost perfectly. A German intelligence report of April 4th stated that the Fourth Army was assembling in Scotland and cited a credible Abwehr source. This source was Roman Czernowski, whose reputation expanded with every message. He is very well regarded, and up till now has produced much accurate information, Oscar Reiler noted. Hugh Astor hit on a way to bind Brutus even more firmly to the Germans, while reinforcing the lie that a fictional American-led army was assembling in Kent. If Brutus were posted notionally to Fusag just before D-Day, he would be in an excellent position to report on the order of battle and operational intentions of Fusag. When the time was ripe, Czernowski would announce that, on account of his intimate knowledge of France and French military procedure, he had been ordered to join a special unit set up under Fusag with the object of recruiting Poles who worked in the German-occupied territory, which was likely to be overrun in the near future. Since many Poles worked in the coal fields east of Calais, this would in itself bolster the idea that the U.S. Army Group was poised to attack the Calais area. Installed at the heart of the fictional army, the little Pole would be perfectly placed to report exactly what was happening, or, more accurately, what was not happening. While Brutus focused on military matters, Bronx fed her handlers The opinions of those whose names and pictures appeared in the columns of fashionable newspapers, a peculiar admixture of the weighty and the irrelevant. Beneath the fluff, she pointed unmistakably to forces assembling to attack the Pas-de-Calais. Lord Kimberley told her an armoured division had moved from Yorkshire to Brighton. One Major Baltiel suggested, Montgomery's HQ may be near Canterbury. A friend in the Army Petroleum Department visited Dover and Folkestone and told her of large invasion stores. Another, George Mitchell, resident in Kent, informed her of roads to beaches widened and concrete barriers removed, suggesting a mass military deployment toward the coast. She helped to focus attention on Scandinavia, relaying a conversation with Commander Sir Guy Domville, who believes Denmark place for invasion. South Norway may be occupied. Her reports were calculated to maintain German uncertainty about the date. Invasion seems imminent, she reported on April 25th. Many U.S. troops leaving West Coast for Southeast Command. A few days later, she corrected herself. Prime Minister's conference indicates invasion not imminent. Montgomery still training invasion force. As Emil Kliman had instructed, Lily Sergeyev headed to Bristol to stay with her relatives and toured the south coast by bicycle, while never leaving London. I make imaginary visits to places which I did not know existed, and from which I bring back rich harvests of information, she wrote in her diary. In this world of fiction, I spend my time in trains, clubs, messes, canteens. I transmit a hodgepodge of descriptions of badges, vehicles, tanks, planes and airfields, garnished with conversations overheard, from which the Germans cannot fail to derive the correct conclusions. Like many spies, caught up in the make-believe, she began to wonder who she really was. For 3 years, I have been acting a part. If I survive the war, will I be able to readapt? Will I be able to become normal again? Mary was pleased with Lily's compliant attitude and her apparent recovery from the death of Babs. She is working hard on her transmissions, she told Tar. Inside, Lily was still seething, and her resentment was redoubled by some ill-advised penny-pinching on the part of MI5. She was told to make her own way to Hampstead by tube. I don't think it would break the War Office to take me there by car, she grumbled. She was moved out of Rugby Mansions and into a smaller flat at 39 Hill Street, where she had to pay rent, albeit reduced. A stern note from John Marriott instructed her, the furniture, fittings, and books will be maintained in the condition that they are now in, and expenses for cleaning, etc., will be paid promptly. I shall expect you to carry out this undertaking. It was the wrong tone to use to an agent who had just risked her life. As Lily pointed out, Kliman was eating out of her hand. The German intelligence service seems entirely satisfied with the information I supply. From time to time, there are congratulations in their messages. The British, on the other hand, were charging her rent and telling her to keep the carpet clean. MI5 refused to reimburse Lily for her lost suitcase, while O'Shagar, the MI6 officer who had promised to look after Babs when she left Gibraltar, had also failed to send on the case's contents. Lily demanded their return, but her possessions were irretrievably lost in the fog of war. The suitcase had contained a jade necklace, a chamois leather pillow, 2 dozen handkerchiefs in a red leather case, and, oddly, 3 shoes, not pairs, valued at £12. Lily reckoned the total value was £128.02, but said she would settle for £50. MI5 declined to pay her a penny. I think we ought not to pay up, declared Marriott, and listed the reasons why. She has no legal claim. She has behaved in an unreasonable fashion in the past, and may therefore do so again. She is trying to bully us. John Masterman agreed. We owe nothing. Mary Shearer was appalled. Treasure is not a money grubber. In view of what she has accomplished, and what we hope to get out of her case, I urge you very strongly to reconsider your decision. I have had a difficult time with Treasure on more than one occasion in the past, and it will not make things any easier if she has a private grudge against the Department and British authorities on the whole, because of their apparently niggardly behaviour towards her for the sake of £50. But the bosses were adamant. John Masterman did not like women in general, and Lily in particular, considering her exceptionally temperamental and troublesome. A few days later, as she and Mary were preparing a wireless message, Lily remarked darkly, "It is very difficult not to take advantage of one's strength when one is the strongest." Mary assumed she was referring to the parsimony of MI5, with its meticulous accounts. Most likely she was alluding to her own secret strength, the knowledge that a couple of undetected dashes in a mass of Morse could bring the entire double-cross system crashing down. Dushko Popov arrived back in Britain on April 13th, with a spring in his step, a fresh batch of questionnaires, and a wad of cash. His last days in Lisbon had been spent wrangling over money, the sort of negotiation at which Popov excelled. He told Alois Schreiber he wanted a staggering $150,000 as an advance payment on future information about Allied invasion plans, and declared that any further activities on his part would depend on the receipt of the stipulated sum. When this was relayed to Berlin, the demand was flatly refused. Popov was offered just 1,500 Swiss francs a month. He threatened to resign. This gave Wilhelm Kubart, the officer who had ousted von Kastorf, an uncomfortable feeling about Popov, as it seemed to him highly improbable that an agent who was really independent and acting for himself could afford to threaten the Abwehr in this manner. Even MI5 considered Popov's demands outrageous, and his threat to quit an unauthorized gamble. In the end, Popov was given $14,000, with the promise of more to come. Before leaving, he had been interviewed again by Schreiber, who told him to find out the date and target of the invasion, which attacks would be real, and which merely diversions. If the landings started, he should stay in London and give up-to-date news on what was happening. Schreiber also asked him to report on bomb damage when the V-1s started landing. But Popov refused, saying they could send some lower-grade agent round to look for holes in London. Popov and Jebsen spent a last night together at the casino in Estoril. At dawn, they shook hands and parted. But as Popov was walking away, Jebsen called him back. "I just wanted to have a good look at you," he said. "It's going to be a while. I feel we are going in different directions." Then he walked away. Back in London, Popov was ebullient, convinced the Germans had complete faith in him. Schreiber had no idea he was playing a double game. The Germans were paying good money. Johnny was safe. "Tricycle is now considered to be the Abwehr's best agent in the UK," MI6 reported. The B1A case officers pored over Popov's latest offerings from the other side, which included a long questionnaire, largely composed of wishful thinking. "What are Churchill's prospects of remaining at the helm? How is his health? Does he by any chance already think of retiring, and if so, when?" To which the answers were good, good, no, and never. Popov's briefcase contained no fewer than 5 typed reports from Jebsen on aircraft production, industrial output, military reserves, and the restructuring of German intelligence. He noted the rise of SS officer Walter Schellenberg, personally agreeable and quite ruthless, who would eventually take over as intelligence supremo. Popov was not unduly worried for Jebsen's safety, since the Gestapo had apparently rescinded an order to have him arrested if he returned to Germany. Even so, Tarr insisted it was much safer that he should remain in Lisbon rather than return to Germany, where he might find himself in an awkward position under which his nerves would give way. Before leaving Lisbon, Popov learned from Marie von Gronau that the SD was sending a representative to interrogate Artist at the end of April or beginning of May in Lisbon in order to clear up certain financial matters. But this was no cause for concern. "These allegations have nothing to do with activities on behalf of the British, but relate to questionable financial transactions. He is satisfied that he can easily clear himself. The intended interrogation is likely to be a formality, so that the file against Jebsen can be closed." Popov was convinced his friend was finally free from danger. MI5 knew otherwise. On February 11th, Hans Brandes, using the codename Ballhorn, sent a message to Berlin reporting that Jebsen was asking suspicious questions and trying to find out about Ostrow. The message was intercepted and decoded at Bletchley Park. Under British instructions, Jebsen was investigating the fake agent Paul Fidromuch, whom MI5 had considered eliminating a few months earlier. Another intercepted message referred to oral reports made by Ballhorn, indicating that Brandes had been snitching during his trip to Berlin. The next day brought further evidence of his duplicity, when Brandes reported that, through the secretaries, Jebsen learns everything that happened in the German intelligence station. Schreiber fired off his own message to Berlin. As cannot continue to work in such circumstances, it is urgently requested that Grass and von Gronau be immediately recalled, giving routine reduction of staff as justification in order not to give Johnny prior warning. What was Brandes up to? Why was he dripping poison into his superior's ears about a man supposed to be his friend? Brandes might be playing some deep game for his own interests, thought Wilson, possibly with the ultimate intention of blackmailing artist or ourselves. He is far from stupid and quite unscrupulous, as are so many spoiled children of rich German industrialists. Brandes had recently been ordered to send his agents to France for instruction. But Brandes had no agents. He had made them all up, and he was now trying to find a way of worming or bribing his way out of this dilemma. Ratting on Jebsen would divert attention. It may well be that in order to prevent his being discovered, he is trying to build himself up with the Abwehr by unmasking artist. Ambitious and avaricious, Brandes knew how much money was being passed to Popov and what Jebsen and von Karstorff had made on the side. A post-war investigation revealed that Brandes was very jealous of the fact that artist was in touch with Tricycle, the best German secret intelligence man in England. Brandes wanted to get rid of him so that he might get the credit for Tricycle's work. The evidence of Brandes's treachery presented MI5 with an appalling dilemma. If Jebsen was warned that his friend was betraying him, he would immediately wonder how MI5 had come by that information, and perhaps conclude that the British must be intercepting German wireless messages. At all costs, most secret sources must be protected. After an intense debate, it was agreed that MI6 would pass on a general warning to Jebsen, hinting that Brandes should not be trusted because some of what he had told Jebsen had turned out to be inaccurate. A telegram was sent to Charles de Salis in Lisbon. Strong impression that Brandes is playing a game of his own and may be trying to provoke artist into confidences which he might use for his own interests. Instruct artist not to expose himself in any way to Brandes, even if this restricts his acquisition of information on our behalf. De Salis was not told that MI5's impressions came from most secret sources. Wilson, meanwhile, sounded out Popov on how well Jebsen might hold up under interrogation, should he be arrested. Popov replied that he had absolutely no doubts whatever that artist would never betray Tricycle or confess his own work for the British under any normal form of interrogation, but he doubts his powers to withstand any physical violence. Jebsen had been hasty in assuming that the clouds have quite rolled away. A storm was gathering with terrifying speed. On April 16th, Schreiber informed Jebsen that they had both been ordered to travel to Biarritz in the south of France to meet the paymaster of the reformed German intelligence service and discuss Popov's demands for money. Sensing a trap, Jebsen refused to go, claiming that this would blow his cover as an independent businessman, since traveling to France required official German approval. Schreiber insisted the telegram from Berlin should be looked upon as an order, and said refusal to obey would be considered desertion. Jebsen dug in his heels. Schreiber reported this back to Berlin and headed off to Biarritz alone. Jebsen, deeply alarmed, told Brandes what had happened. Brandes immediately sent a telegram to Berlin. On the 17th, Johnny told me he had been ordered to a conference in Biarritz on the subject of Ivan. Johnny said he saw a clear trap in this, and was certain that his immediate arrest was intended in Biarritz. Johnny added that if in the next few days any further signs of mistrust existing towards him on the part of Balin are to be observed, he intends to draw his own conclusions and will inform Ivan in good time. Further signs of mistrust were not long in coming. The next day, the office secretaries, Lily Grass and Marie von Gronau, were ordered to return to Berlin within 24 hours. This was a routine reduction of staff, Schreiber claimed, since all secretaries who have been here more than 2 years are to leave on the principle that they have had a long period of work in a pleasant place and should therefore be moved to somewhere less pleasant. But Jebsen knew his moles within the system were being weeded out. The women were instructed not to speak to him before they left. Both ignored the order. Jebsen even escorted Marie to the airport. As they parted, he said something that made her even more convinced that he must be a British agent. 3 days after the end of hostilities, a British pilot will report to a restaurant in Flensburg, Schleswig-Holstein, the Grossadel Beilund, and if you are present, he will pick you up and bring you to England. Marie promised to be there. Jebsen met Charles Dessalis at the safe house. Jebsen was deeply agitated, smoking furiously with trembling fingers. The MI6 man passed on the veiled warning about Brandis, but Jebsen seemed preoccupied with the forced departure of the secretaries. "Artist does not consider this a very good sign," Dessalis reported. "He feels very bitter. He rails against the pig-headed administration which has ordered this." The order to go to Biarritz with Schreiber had been a test of his loyalty and obedience. "Further traps of this nature will be laid," he predicted. Despite the precariousness of his own position, Jebsen had some important new intelligence to report. The latest strategic assessment by the German General Staff, as presented to a conference of generals in France. This predicted a large-scale invasion attempt across the Channel and in southern France, revealed doubts as to whether Norway could be defended successfully, and concluded that a precise assessment of American troops in the UK would be decisive. The Germans appeared to be concentrating on exactly the right areas. Before she was ordered home, Lily Grass had passed on some good news. "Tricycle's reports have made a tremendous impression in Berlin, and the General Staff are considering modifying their plans in consequence. The last report had already been classified as being as good as sure, which is an almost unparalleled evaluation." By the end of the meeting, Jebsen had regained some of his composure. "Artist is confident that Brandis will keep him warned of future traps, and hopes that in this way the tests may be negotiated successfully. If this can be done, Tricycle's position as the ace Abwehr agent in the UK will be assured, and all thenceforward should be comparatively easy." Before they parted, Dessalis told Jebsen to be careful. "Am I not always careful?" said Jebsen, with a pale smile. The warning about Brandis had not registered, or perhaps Jebsen chose to ignore it. He was a firm believer in friendship. Later the same day, he showed a document to Brandis, who was on the radio to Berlin within hours. "A telegram which has just arrived from England was shown to me by Johnny at his house. It was signed by his friend Baronet Anthony Rothschild. The contents read as follows. Don't worry, our business shall be finished very soon." This was, of course, part of Jebsen's elaborate tale about a rich member of the Rothschild family, now downgraded from peer to baronet, who was helping him to get a refugee visa to Britain. He probably showed it to Brandis, knowing he might soon have to disappear. There was no such person as Sir Anthony Rothschild, but Brandis did not know this, and to his mind, the telegram conveyed a hidden meaning, that the time was nearly due for artists to come over to the British with such information as he had been able to gather. Brandis told Berlin that Jebsen was again showing noticeable curiosity about Ostro. Robertson summoned Masterman, Marriott, and Wilson to a crisis meeting. The intercepts revealed that while Artist considered Brandis to be entirely his friend, Brandis was reporting unfavorably on Artist. On the other hand, most secret sources indicated that the Gestapo was no longer on his trail, and although the authorities wanted to interview him, they were concerned solely with financial matters. If Jebsen was asked why he was so interested in Ostro, he could take a bold line and insist that it was his desire to expose Ostro if he could find proof that Ostro was a fraud, which, as MI5 well knew, he was. Wilson summed up the situation, while admitting this was too complicated to enable one to make any very confident appreciation of the position. Brandis is clearly telling tales about artists, but there is no indication, at least so far, that Brandis is trying to suggest artist is working for the British. I am personally satisfied that the telegram summoning artist to Biarritz was not a trap, but artist is apt to get into a state of nerves where he quite genuinely imagines traps which do not exist. He may not have seen as clearly as we have that the Gestapo seems now to be convinced that he is best left in Lisbon, and he may quite honestly fear that the Gestapo are behind the attempt to get him into occupied territory where they will arrest him. No immediate action can be taken by us. There is a risk that, despite our warning, artist may continue to place some confidence in Brandis, but we cannot strengthen our warning without danger to our sources. They agreed to do nothing. The protection of most secret sources was paramount. I see no reason to be unduly nervous, said Wilson, with a confidence he certainly did not feel. Jebsen, meanwhile, decided to brazen it out with his bosses and conduct his own test. He told Schreiber he had received a message from Popov, stating he would brook no further delay over money. To Jebsen's surprise, Schreiber was most accommodating. He agreed to cable Berlin immediately and came back with the answer that he had received immediate instructions to hand over all available funds to artist. He then presented Jebsen with $75,000 in cash. This, he said, was only a down payment. Jebsen was ecstatic. Artist considers this proof all is well, and that General Staff will act on strength of Tricycle's reports, Charles de Salis reported back to London. He now believes the investigation is over, and Abwehr are satisfied both he and Tricycle are sound. Tricycle's position as an ace agent is assured. The crisis was over. Schreiber could not have been more friendly, and told him that Berlin had cabled at the last minute to say that Jebsen was not needed at the Biarritz meeting after all. There was even talk of bringing back his lover, Marie von Gronau. Jebsen wrote a triumphant letter to Popov. You will know by reports coming from Korb, de Salis's cover name, about the tests the Abwehr tried to carry out. I am quite happy that it is over now, and I congratulate you on being my beloved Führer's best agent without any doubt, because, after having hesitated for some time, the Abwehr have decided the money should be transferred to you as arranged. I got $75,000, of which I will send $50,000 today. We might settle accounts later, but my share I am keeping here because I might be in need of some money to bribe heaven knows whom. Please give my best greetings to Ian, Frank, and the Bentons. Be a good boy and try to behave. Yours always, Johnny. Relief flooded through B1A. The Tricycle network was safe, and with it the rest of the double-cross deception. This called for a celebratory dinner with Popov as guest of honor, to be held at the Hyde Park Hotel on April 26th. A report was sent to Churchill. The agent Tricycle has now returned from visiting his masters in Lisbon. He has once more succeeded in persuading them of his complete reliability and has extracted from them a large sum of dollars as an advance against his future services. He has received an interesting questionnaire. They appear to have the highest respect for him. The day before the dinner, Jebsen met de Salis again and confirmed that everything was fine. Schreiber had congratulated him on his handling of Popov and told him he was to receive a medal, a War Merit Cross, Kriegsverdienstkreis, or KVK, first class, without swords, a civilian medal usually awarded for bravery behind the lines. Now that he was no longer under suspicion, Jebsen said he planned to go to Berlin, where he would gather more information for British intelligence. From artist's point of view, the outcome is a complete triumph, de Salis reported. To crown it all, artist has been awarded the KVK first class, an honor shared by no one in Lisbon. Schreiber, in particular, is envious. Jebsen dictated a letter to Mabel Harbottle, now fully in his confidence, telling Popoff the good news. A proof of the fact that Schreiber did not tell me stories, that is, lie, is that I got another decoration, and this time the KVK First Class. First Class probably was given because you double-crossed them First Class. I feel a little bit ashamed of getting the decoration for the work you and Ian did. I made up my mind to give it to Ian. Unfortunately, I cannot get the Germans to put his name on the certificate, but I shall give him the decoration itself. If, as I hope, he collects curiosities, he might find a place for it in his collection. After all, he is an exceptional man, and has the exceptional honor of getting a decoration with a swastika on it. Schreiber had promised more money. Knowing your mentality, I am sure you are much more interested in this than in the really funny story of my decoration. Brandes is no longer your friend, because he is terribly afraid you might betray the circumstances and date of the invasion, and not only prolong the war, but endanger his position as only 50% Aryan, which must be more and more difficult. It might come out in the end that he is going to hang instead of the Nazi leaders if the war goes on for a very long time. Last time I forgot to send my best greetings to Frano, de Bona, Agent Freak. This was because, at the time, I didn't remember that he should know that I know what, after all, we all know. I sometimes forget to whom I have to cover what, and what I have to cover to whom. I think this letter is too long already. Besides, I have to think of the poor lady who has to type it, and probably has something better to do than to amuse you. Mabel Harbottle wrote in the margin with what, for her, was very nearly coquetry. The lady herself is of course delighted at the thought of helping to keep you amused. He ended with a flourish. I hope you will give my love to all you can give it to without spoiling your, my, or anybody else's cover. To you I can give my love anyhow. Yours, as always, Johnny. The letter was typical Jebsen, funny, insouciant, mercenary, and more worried about the fate of Hans Brandes than about his own. De Salis reported that Jebsen had been in a very good mood, and the difference between this and the last meeting, when he was obviously worried, was very noticeable. Jebsen agreed to return to the safe house on May 5th, 1 month and 1 day before D-Day. Amid all the excitement and relief, no one spotted a message sent the day before Popoff's dinner from Alois Schreiber to Georg Hansen, the new head of German counterintelligence. The carrying out of the threatened plan is imminent. Request your permission to prevent this plan, even if it should become necessary to use extreme measures. Hansen gave his permission. The dinner at the Hyde Park Hotel was most convivial. The key players in the tricycle case were all there, in evening attire. Guy Liddle, Tar Robertson, John Masterman, John Marriott, and Ian Wilson, who had just steered the network through such rocky waters. MI6 was represented by Frank Foley. MI5's Director General, Sir David Petrie, raised a toast to Agent Tricycle. Popoff was full of praise for Wilson, for whom he clearly has the greatest respect, Liddle noted in his diary. I think he realizes that if Wilson had not been at his side coaching him, he could never have achieved the position which he has now reached. He told me also that Wilson had made a very good impression on Artist. In a rare departure from intelligence protocol, as a mark of trust in Popoff, all those present used their own names. They did, however, keep one secret from Popoff. It was unknown to Tricycle that the cigars smoked at dinner were kindly provided by Dr. Emil Kliman of the Paris Abwehr Station. 21. Operation Dora. On the afternoon of April 29th, Alois Schreiber telephoned Johnny Jebsen and asked him to come to the offices on Rua Buenos Aires, as he wanted to discuss the award of Jebsen's War Merit Cross. Jebsen had a friend staying with him in Estoril, Heinz Paul Moldenauer, a young Abwehr officer from the Cologne branch. Schreiber suggested that Jebsen bring Moldenauer along, as he would like to discuss some intelligence matters with him. Jebsen and Moldenauer arrived at the office at dusk. The place was deserted. In Schreiber's outer office sat two men Jepsen knew only vaguely, a signals officer named Bliel and Karl Meyer, a burly civilian car mechanic. Schreiber welcomed Jepsen and Muldenauer warmly and, after chatting for a few minutes, invited Jepsen to step into the inner office alone. Once Jepsen was seated and the door closed, Schreiber calmly explained that he had orders to take him to Berlin by force, since he would not go of his own free will. Jepsen made a bolt for the door, but Schreiber was faster and fitter. He punched Jepsen once and knocked him cold. When Jepsen came to, he found himself tied to a chair, along with Muldenauer, who had been overpowered by Meyer in the adjoining room. Schreiber told his captives what would happen next. They would be knocked out, and while unconscious, placed in two large trunks, in which they would be shipped by car the same evening over the Portuguese-Spanish and Spanish-French borders to Biarritz. To guard against all possible surprises at the borders, he had decided to drug them by injections. Schreiber asked them to surrender without a struggle. Jepsen seemed to realize that the time to fight would come later. Both of them submitted to the injections. At around 2 a.m., a Studebaker sedan with diplomatic plates and two large trunks in the boot arrived at Badajoz, the border crossing into Spain. In the rear seat sat Schreiber. Meyer knew border conditions and officials personally, and the car was waved through. They drove north, stopping only for a few rests in the open. From Madrid, Schreiber sent a telegram to Hansen. Mission has been carried out as far as Madrid. At midnight, the party crossed into France. In Biarritz, Jepsen and Muldenauer, still heavily drugged, were removed from the trunks and handed over to an intelligence officer named Fuchs. Schreiber sent another cable. Luggage handed over Biarritz to be sent on to Berlin. Undertaking was successful and everything all right. The following day, Hans Brandes in Lisbon received a message of congratulations from Georg Hansen. Many thanks for reports and special recommendation. Plans for the kidnapping of Johnny Jepsen had been laid 2 weeks earlier. The message from Brandes, warning that Jepsen might be about to defect, had provoked considerable excitement in Berlin. Jepsen's desertion had to be prevented at all costs, Hansen told Kubat, who was instructed to see personally that Jepsen reached German-occupied territory, or at any rate to thwart any attempt on his part to reach Allied territory. Kubat briefed Schreiber, telling him that Berlin had proof that Jepsen had been working for both sides for some time and was now prepared to go over to the Allies, while also seeking to take financial advantage of the Abwehr. Stopping this defection was of extreme importance to the war effort. Schreiber had tried to object, pointing out that this was surely a police matter, but Kubat was insistent. The operation should be conducted in strict secrecy. Neither the counter-espionage section in Lisbon, nor the Gestapo, nor the Portuguese police were to know anything about the affair. The Abwehr and the SD, the Nazi Party Intelligence Service, were not yet fully merged, and this was strictly a matter for the Abwehr. Once Jepsen was in Berlin, he would have to answer only to the military authorities and under no circumstance to the SD. Still dubious, Schreiber cabled Berlin asking Hansen to accept full responsibility in case the abduction caused difficulties with the Portuguese. Hansen replied by specifically charging Schreiber with the task and telling him to hurry up. How Jepsen was bagged and delivered to Berlin was left entirely up to Schreiber. The Nazis had a taste for attaching female codenames to the most secret operations. Their espionage campaign against Britain was Lena. The plan to seize the Canary Islands was Isabella. The kidnapping of Jepsen was codenamed Operation Dora. Jepsen was suspected of being a double agent and probably a crook, but the real reason for the urgency and secrecy of Operation Dora had little to do with either his spying or his dodgy dealings. Hansen, Kubat, and many other intelligence officers were now actively plotting to kill Hitler. Jepsen, if he absconded, would derail those plans. Hansen was deeply implicated in the anti-Nazi conspiracy that would culminate in the 20 July plot to assassinate the Führer. His home at Rangsdorf was used as a meeting place for the conspirators. Like many of the plotters, Hansen's loathing for Hitler was coupled with a deeply conservative patriotism, the urgent desire to save Germany before Hitler destroyed the fatherland utterly. He wanted to remove Hitler and then launch a concerted assault on the Soviets, even if that meant Germany ended up with the status of a British dominion. Kubat shared his views, believing Hansen was the man to put things right. The previous March, Hansen had begun to instruct Kubat in the details of his machinations against the German regime. By May, a plot was in place. Hansen told Kubat he had arranged for someone to place some British-manufactured explosives in an aircraft in which Hitler was to fly. Once Hitler was dead, the anti-Nazi resistance would rise up and overthrow the regime. But Jebsen was in the way. Himmler's SD was itching for an opportunity to purge the remaining Canarist loyalists and anti-Nazi elements within German intelligence, men like Hansen, Kubat, and Schreiber. If Jebsen defected, Hansen feared, then the blame would be pinned on what remained of the Abwehr as yet more proof of treachery. Hitler's henchmen would pounce on the Abwehr, as they had done after the Vermehren incident, Hansen told Kubat, which would put an end to schemes he was already concocting for the liquidation of Hitler and Himmler and the ultimate overthrow of the Nazi Party. A post-war investigation into the power struggles within German intelligence concluded that Operation Dora was a preemptive strike aimed at shielding the conspirators from their Nazi enemies. The Vermehren case had been used by Himmler and Schellenberg as a lever for gaining control of the Abwehr. Hansen and Kubat were particularly concerned to prevent another desertion. Jebsen was kidnapped to preserve the plot to kill Hitler, a plot in which Jebsen would have been delighted to participate. Schreiber had lulled Jebsen into thinking he was safe. The cash, the medal, the soothing words were all aimed at ensuring Jebsen did not flee before Schreiber was ready. The unexpected appearance of Heinz Moldenauer at Jebsen's house complicated matters. Moldenauer was the half-Jewish son of a former German minister and one of a number of anti-Nazis who have avoided active participation in the war by undertaking service with the Abwehr, which they make no effort to carry out conscientiously. He was regarded with suspicion in Berlin. Schreiber assumed he must also be planning to defect and decided to abduct him too. If innocent, Moldenauer would have no trouble clearing himself with the military authorities in Berlin. But Moldenauer was not planning to defect. He was simply in the worst place at the worst possible time. On April 27th, the day after the party for Popov, Hansen authorized the payment of 25,000 escudos to Schreiber in order to ensure the execution of Operation Dora. Schreiber bought a sleeping drug from a Lisbon chemist, a syringe, rope, and two trunks, large enough for a grown person, fitted with adequately large openings for ventilation. 4 days later, Jebsen, dazed, battered, and terrified, was lying on the floor of a cell in the Gestapo prison in Berlin. Jebsen's disappearance sent a bolt of pure horror through the double-cross team. The dreadful news arrived in a single line from Lisbon. Artist has disappeared since the afternoon of 29-4, and investigations have been instituted. Most secret sources offered no clues to explain the mystery. This has clearly been done in great secrecy, wrote Wilson. The first the SD in Lisbon knew of it was a message stating that Jebsen had been taken to France by the Abwehr, as he was acknowledged as being unreliable. But what did unreliable mean? The stakes went far beyond the fate of one man. If Jebsen's captors considered him untrustworthy, they might well suspect Popov, his best friend and agent, and if Popov was identified as a double agent, that would inevitably cast suspicion on the other controlled agents in the UK. But worse than that, Jebsen knew the entire Garbo network was fiction, feeding false information in huge quantity back to Berlin. He had told Wilson he believed all the German spies in Britain were frauds. If Jebsen revealed this to his captors, The Germans would re-examine all the information received from their agents and look for the patterns of disinformation. They would quickly work out that the spies were directing them to defend the Pas-de-Calais and Norway. Operation Fortitude would be blown, with incalculable consequences. The invasion was just 1 month away, and the immense machinery of Operation Overlord was already in motion. Popov had told Ian Wilson he was afraid that Yibsen would break down if physical pressure were applied. His abduction could spell disaster. Wilson frantically combed most secret sources for evidence of what might have happened to Yibsen. "A number of messages on MSS have become available," he reported, "but none of them seem very conclusive." 2 days after Yibsen's disappearance, Popov's brother in Yugoslavia was still at large. If Dushko was under suspicion, they would surely have pulled in Ivo. Wilson tried to sound a positive note. "Artist's present troubles arise primarily from the reports against him made by Brandes. The general tenor of the intercepts seems to be that the Abwehr are afraid that Artist was intending to go over to the British or to cause the tricycle messages to be intercepted, rather than that Artist is already a traitor to Germany or that Tricycle is a controlled agent. If they do not yet suspect the latter, there is a good chance that Artist will not be subjected to pressure which will break him." There was no sign that the Germans suspected Popov. Indeed, the capture of Yibsen may have been ordered in part because it was feared that if he defected to the Allies, this would compromise a spy that Hansen considered the one agent of real value in the UK. Here was yet more black irony. Yibsen, it seems, had been abducted not because the Germans suspected Popov was a double agent, but because they didn't. If Yibsen remained out of the hands of the Gestapo and the SD, there was just a chance that the self-interest of those involved might protect him. All the parties involved have their weak spots. Brandes will fear a counter-investigation. Schreiber will not willingly admit that Tricycle has been fooling them. Hansen will not willingly reach a conclusion that will undermine the whole Abwehr. But these were fragile hopes, and Wilson knew it. The next few days will provide evidence to show clearly whether he is merely to be interrogated on relatively minor charges and kept in preventive custody, or forced to disclose the true position of Tricycle and possibly other controlled agents. If Yibsen was made to talk, then instead of pulling off a great deception coup, the double-cross team would have set the scene for a bloodbath on the beaches of Normandy. At a crisis meeting on May 9th, John Masterman laid out the grim situation. "The cover plan has been, to a considerable extent, built up on the reports of double-cross agents. The fact that Artist, who is fully cognizant of the Tricycle network and has some knowledge of the other cases, has fallen under suspicion and been removed to Berlin, therefore threatens the whole cover plan. We cannot tell exactly why Artist has fallen under suspicion. We only know that he is regarded as unreliable. His unreliability may be connected with his financial operations, his intrigues, or his unwise inquisitiveness about the undertakings of Brandes and Ostro, and not with his dealings with Tricycle at all. There is no proof that treason on the part of Artist is part of the charge, but obviously under interrogation at Berlin, he may reveal what he knows. We must act on the assumption that the Tricycle case may be blown. In these circumstances, what should be done? We should leave the door open to continue our present policy, in the hope that the Berlin investigation may be confined to Artist's personal delinquencies and leave Tricycle untouched. With good fortune, we should get information through secret sources telling us how the inquiry proceeds. It may be that Tricycle will be confirmed in his position of trust and that we can operate him as before. The case of the other agents is more difficult. Clearly, they must not change their style in any way, but should they, or should they not, continue to implement Fortitude? The danger of their doing so is that if all or most of them are blown as a result of Artist's revelations, their traffic will be read in reverse and interpreted accordingly. Masterman laid out the options. 1. They should, for the time being, continue to operate without change, though specific indication of the false objective should be avoided. 2. attempt by diversity of messages to create confusion in the enemy's mind, even though we have to abandon the hope of getting a complete cover plan over to the enemy. 3. If we come to the conclusion that practically all the agents are in fact blown, we could take the extreme step of abandoning all efforts at deception and deny all information to the enemy by closing down all agents. Shutting down the double-cross system would nullify more than 4 years of hard work and extreme risk, but it would leave the enemy deprived of all information from agents at a time when he needs it most, and would have to prepare himself in the dark to meet any eventuality. Masterman's recommendation was to continue the deception, but if, and only if, the blowing of Tricycle and Garbo is certain, we close down all agents shortly before D-Day. Within B-1A, Jebsen's capture sparked a blazing row, the worst so far. Tommy Harris was particularly enraged. He had warned that Jebsen was a liability, and now the delicate structure of deception he had created with Juan Puyol was liable to be smashed to pieces. The confidence which has been deposited in Artis during the last few months has left him in little doubt that Kulenthal's network in this country is controlled by us. Developments in the Artis case have, to say the least, very seriously compromised the Garbo channel for passing operational deception. Harris did not believe that most secret sources would give sufficient warning of disaster. The intercepts, after all, had failed to alert MI5 before Jebsen was snatched, the same night that our confidence in him was at its height. Garbo could be blown without our getting any warning on MSS that he has been denounced by Artist. The Tricycle network should be shut down, said Harris, immediately and permanently. It took Guy Liddell to point out that this would amount to Jebsen's death sentence, for it would prove to his captors that both he and Popoff had been in league with the British. Packing up Tricycle will finish Artist, he observed. If the double agents were exposed, would the Germans be able to deduce the cover plan and the real plan from the previous traffic? Could the Germans extract, in less than a month, the essence of Operation Fortitude from the reams of misinformation they had received? Masterman thought it would require a lengthy and exhaustive study to sift the truth from the falsehood. But Harris disagreed. I maintain that the enemy could, within 24 hours, analyze the entire B1A traffic for the last 2 months, and they would be able to draw the conclusions that the cover plan threat is against the Pas-de-Calais, and we wish the enemy to believe that the assault will be two-pronged. Such a discovery by the enemy would be catastrophic. In the hands of the Gestapo inquisitors, Jebsen might reveal the true state of affairs, and so compromise the entire network of controlled agents in this country. From now onwards, the Germans might, at any moment, tumble to the fact that all their spies in England were under Allied control. They would then conclude that the messages they were receiving were the opposite of the truth. There could only be two reasonable objectives for the cross-channel assault, namely the Pas-de-Calais and Normandy. If the Germans perceived we were trying to induce them to believe that we were coming to the Pas-de-Calais, the true objective would thus be automatically disclosed. As the dispute raged, Tar Robertson found himself under attack from MI6. Charles de Salis had lost not only a valued agent, but also a friend. The MI6 officer had been instructed only to warn Jebsen that Brandis was an unreliable informant. He was not told that Brandis was informing on Jebsen, and had warned Berlin that he was about to flee. When de Salis discovered that he had been given a doctored version of events, he hit the roof and accused MI5 of throwing Jebsen to the wolves. Why lead me up the garden path? The obvious way of putting this over to Artist was to attribute the information to one of 23700 sources, a reference to MI6 informants. Jebsen's respect for 23700 penetration of the German service was profound, de Salis argued, and if told that the warnings came from a British spy, he would have been really on his guard and would no doubt have been suspicious enough not to fall into the German trap. De Salis accused MI5 of giving him misleading information, of which the acute danger to Jebsen was the most flagrant and tragic example. If he had been allowed to warn Yebsen properly, Dessalles railed, then the kidnapping could have been thwarted. If I cannot be trusted to act a little comedy as simple as this, I should not be here at all. Tarr struggled to defend himself. No one can have greater concern than I do over the affairs of artist, but a direct warning could not be given to artist. We had no indication that there was any imminent danger of an attempt to kidnap artist. The most careful consideration was given to whether we should inform artist that Brandis was reporting on him, and it was accepted by all the numerous officers here that we could not run the risk to the source, most secret sources, that would be involved in warning artist. All we could do was warn artist against putting confidence in Brandis. At my suggestion, the warning was based on the suspicion we had of the accuracy of Brandis' reports. Operation Dora was not known to us until after the event had taken place. There was a message the day before, not mentioning artist by name, which, had we at the time had sufficient knowledge to link it with artist, would have indicated that he was in danger of some sort. But because of the source, we could not have taken the risk of giving him any additional warning. I have naturally given a great deal of thought to this matter, and I am satisfied that we went as far as we possibly could in protecting artist. Tarr was blustering. His excuses were thin, as he was well aware. He knew there was a world of difference between the suggestion that Brandis was unreliable and a tip-off that he was actively betraying Yebsen. He knew that a warning, carefully couched, would not necessarily have alerted Yebsen to most secret sources. He knew that he and his team, paranoid about protecting the Allies' most valuable secret, had failed to appreciate the mortal danger to Yebsen, and as a consequence, he was in prison, probably undergoing torture, and possibly already dead. Tarr was a good and honorable man, and in his heart he must have known that Yebsen had trusted the British completely, and they had let him down. This was the worst moment of his war, perhaps the worst moment of his life. Dread throbbed through the building at 58 St. James's Street. Anthony Blunt told me Tommy Harris was extremely worried about the artist situation. Little wrote, "The whole situation is rather worrying. Tricycle has been told that all is not well with artist, who has disappeared. This news obviously caused Tricycle considerable worry, as it obviously showed it was possible that artist had been kidnapped. MI5 could not reveal most secret sources' evidence of his abduction, but Popov soon reached the independent realization that his friend had, by trick or force, been taken back to Germany. Another Abwehr defector, Hans Russer, who knew Yebsen well, was asked whether his former colleague would be able to withstand interrogation. Yebsen was a mine of information, and had always talked too much, he said. Under third-degree pressure, he would tell the Germans everything. As the crisis erupted, Winston Churchill was kept, if not exactly in the dark, then certainly in the shade. Blunt's report was a masterpiece of deliberate understatement. There has been an unfortunate development in the case of Tricycle, the true purport and consequences of which have not yet been determined. It was learnt from most secret sources that artist, his spymaster, was lured with great secrecy into France, and there dispatched to Berlin. The reasons for this action are for the moment obscure, but it is certain that the Tricycle case is passing through a most critical phase and must be handled with the greatest care in view of Overlord. Unfortunate, rather worrying, most critical. These were delicate British euphemisms for what one officer described as near panic. MI5 had once worried Churchill might go off the deep end if he knew too much about espionage matters. It can only be imagined how far off the deep end he would have plunged had he learned not only that the double-cross system was in danger of unravelling, but that the invasion itself was in jeopardy. Popov had already sent the Germans copious deceptive material relating to Fortitude. But could he continue to do so, given that Yebsen might expose him at any moment? If he suddenly ceased to send good information, or altered the thrust of the deception, the Germans would smell a rat. One option was to shut him down. But, as Little pointed out, this would undoubtedly put artist completely in the cart, and seriously jeopardize Tricycle's brother. By sheer good fortune, an opportunity presented itself to suspend the tricycle network without further endangering Jebsen. Earlier in May, a message had been intercepted revealing that German intelligence knew Frauno de Bona, Agent Freak, was suspected by some of his fellow Yugoslavs of spying for Germany. If de Bona was under suspicion, he would naturally be brought in for questioning. This gives us an opportunity of closing down Tricycle's transmitter, at any rate temporarily, wrote Little. If we see from the traffic that Artist is once more on a good wicket, we can go on the air again. On May 18th, de Bona sent a message to Lisbon saying he was going off the air, which was followed by a letter from Popoff, in secret ink, reporting that certain inquiries were in progress against Freak, and for that reason they had temporarily hidden the wireless set. The other double agents would continue building Operation Fortitude to its climax. Henceforth, Brutus, Garbo, Bronx, and Treasure would only hint that the Pas-de-Calais was the target, but not state this as bald fact in case Jebsen revealed the deception. Once the troops had landed, the spies would point specifically to Calais as the target of a second, even bigger assault by the fictional Fusag. After D-Day, we can go absolutely all out. At the same time, most secret sources would be dissected daily for any indication that Jebsen had confessed, either willingly or under duress. If it became clear he had told all, B1A would shut down Double Cross and hope the Germans would not have time to work out Operation Fortitude. The race was on, to put as much of the deception in place as possible before D-Day and pray that Jebsen did not crack too soon. The deception, and perhaps the success or failure of the invasion itself, now depended on the fortitude of Johnny Jebsen, a strange and dishonest spy with unhealthy habits who might, even now, be languishing in a Nazi torture cell. Masterman was pessimistic. Under interrogation, it was to be presumed that much, if not all, of the history of his activities would come to light, and in that case, many of our best cases were doomed. The whole deception, through Double Cross, was in danger. Every hour mattered. The longer Jebsen held out, the less time the Germans would have to unravel the deception. All the Double Cross team knew was that Jebsen had been bound for Berlin. "We do not know how quickly the interrogation of Artist will be started," Wilson remarked miserably. "I hope the RAF have made the train journey from Biarritz to Berlin a lengthy matter." 22. Guest of the Gestapo. The Double Crossers needed to get inside Hitler's head, and for their purposes the most direct access to the mind of the Führer was via Lieutenant Colonel Alexis von Rühner, the head of Fremde Heere West, or FHW, the intelligence branch of the High Command of the German Army. The FHW gathered information from all branches of German intelligence: aerial reconnaissance, wireless intercepts, POW interrogations, captured documents, and spy reports, and tried to make sense of it. Every letter from Bronx, every transmission by Treasure and Brutus, every report from Tricycle, ended up eventually with this erudite, imaginative, level-headed intelligence expert, whose monumental task it was to explain what, in military terms, it all amounted to. Every day, von Rühner's intelligence branch, a secret hive inside a concrete bunker at Zossen, south of Berlin, produced a 3-page situation report with an update on enemy military activity. The intelligence unit also compiled a more detailed picture of the order of battle every fortnight, and an occasional long-range forecast of Allied intentions. These were distributed to the relevant intelligence agencies, the High Command, and the commanders in the field. In the case of France, Field Marshal Gerd von Rundstedt, supreme commander of the German armies in the West. Von Rühner, an aristocrat with refined manners, pious beliefs, and a sinuously clever mind, was aided by the head of the English section, Major Roger Michael, who could not have been more different from his boss. Half English and half German, Michael was a bald, back-slapping, heavy-drinking hearty who had played rugby for Germany. He had a jolly, easy, happy disposition, but a quick understanding of essentials. He was also credited with insight into the British mentality, having spent much of his youth in Britain. He was Gisela Ashley's opposite number. Hitler had complete faith in von Rühner. As Anton Staubwasser, Rommel's intelligence chief put it, the opinions held by Hitler and OKW, the supreme command of the German armed forces, about the invasion were based principally on the information supplied by FHW and did not deviate from that department's ideas in essentials. If von Rohner and his analysts could be fooled into thinking that another army, far larger than the real D-Day force, was assembling on Britain's coast, then Hitler himself would probably fall for the deception. What Hitler did not know, and never knew, was that Alexis von Rohner and Roger Michell were running their own deception operation. From 1943 onward, von Rohner overestimated the strength of Allied forces in Britain consistently, massively, and quite deliberately. Once an enemy army unit had been identified and logged by the analysts, it was never removed from what von Rohner called the Feindbild, his picture of the enemy. More than that, by the spring of 1944, he was intentionally embellishing the picture. In January 1944, Michael told von Rohner that the troop estimates they sent to the High Command were being deliberately reduced by the SD, which took every opportunity to undermine the experts in military intelligence before being passed to Hitler. Michael reckoned the numbers were being halved, so he made a suggestion that was logical, daring, and extremely dangerous. Why not double the figures? Then something close to the right number would be achieved. That, at least, was how he rationalized the plan to von Rohner, who went along with it, knowing that inflating these vital numbers might cost him his life. Every single sighting of an Allied unit was chalked up as genuine, no matter how feeble the evidence. If only part of a troop was spotted, it was assumed the entire force was present, even when other parts of the unit were spotted elsewhere. Every anomaly was quietly wished away. Gradually at first, and then faster and faster, the numerical gap between the forces that were really poised to invade France and the statistics being relayed to Hitler grew ever wider. At the beginning of 1944, FHW estimated there were 55 divisions in Britain, when there were really only 37. By mid-May, von Rohner calculated that 77 enemy divisions were in place, and by D-Day, he had magnified the 44 divisions in Britain to a remarkable 89, more than enough men under arms to launch diversionary attacks on Normandy and Norway and a main assault on the Pas de Calais.